This evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse, we are going back to the 14th century. Why, you might ask me? Well, there was a certain well-known English poet named Geoffrey Chaucer, who lived during that time and wrote much poetry. My guest this evening is Dr. Carol Pullum from Cedar Crest College. My name is John Pierce. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. Neil Heaver, our Director of Operations, is working the board for us this evening. Before we get into the subject of Chaucer, which, Carol, is one of your very favorite subjects, let's find out about you a little bit. You bring a wide range of interests to the classroom. You're a graduate of Cedar Crest College with majors in music and English.
Yes, I am.
Interesting combination.
Yes.
What did you do with music?
With music, I did support myself during graduate school by teaching piano lessons. I was a piano performance major at Cedar Crest, so I did use it initially right off the bat. And during the rest of my life, I've always been active in music. I currently sing with the Camerata Singers, conducted by Alan Burney. And I occasionally play for weddings and funerals, unfortunately. But I've kept up with my music.
So
I'm always involved.
Both instrumental and vocal.
It is, yes. Mm-hmm. Instrumental and vocal.
Well, let's give a shout out to our program called Lehigh Valley, called WDIY Classics.
Yes.
Because frequently Alan Burney is a guest on that show. And just for our listeners who are not aware, we have that show on from 9 a.m. until noon, Monday through Friday, for your listening pleasure. Lots of great music on that. Dr. Pullum completed her PhD in English at Lehigh University, and now she's back to Cedar Crest as a faculty member and teaches Chaucer, topics in medieval literature, and linguistics. So, in topics in medieval literature, Carol, are we talking about such things as love and marriage?
We could be. I have never taught yet a course in that topic alone, but it certainly would make, I think, an interesting course.
I do too, and I think it would grab the students' interest right away.
It absolutely would. The most recent course I've taught in the topics in medieval literature was women and medieval literature. And for that course, I taught literature not only written by women, such as Marjorie Kemp's autobiography, but famous women characters who feature in medieval literature, such as the Wife of Bath.
Yes.
So we did both. And then we also read the anti-feminist writers that were very current in the Middle Ages, even though many of them had written long before Chaucer's time, but in the early Middle Ages.
And you also teach The Quest, which is a course in Arthurian literature through the ages, and that's in the honors program.
Yes.
What a great name for the for that course, The Quest.
I love that course. I love that course because we can gain perspective. And one of the things I'm always looking for is to help the students gain perspective on today's world by looking at things of the past. In The Quest, we start with the earliest mentions of Arthur. We look at the question of whether Arthur really existed or not as a historical character. And if he did, was he, did he exist in the way that he has been depicted at various times over
probably
history?
Not.
Probably
yeah,
not.
Right.
No, no.
And nobody knows if he really did exist.
I know.
King Arthur.
I know.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well,
yes.
Topics of other courses that you teach, London on the Page. What's that?
Yes, it's a course in, and this course I think I've taught maybe three different times in three different ways, but it's basically the literature of London, literature that takes place in London, literature that has been affected by London in some way, or the author has been influenced by London in some way.
What's the earliest century that you deal with in that course?
It's the 14th century. The earliest is, yes, because Chaucer lived in London. Mm-hmm. We even know where he rented some of his apartments during his lifetime. Mm-hmm. And so I don't do the entire works of Chaucer. That takes a whole course or even more. Actually, it takes two semesters to do all of Chaucer.
And how far forward do you come with the course on London?
All the way up to the present day. We have read in the present day, we've read Zadie Smith. We've read Neil Gaiman. Neil Gaiman has a wonderful novel that takes place on the underground and contrasts the above ground versus the underground, Neverwhere. It's very good. And if you know London, it's even better.
Yeah, it's much better when you've traveled
yes,
to the places,
it is.
Right?
It is, yes.
Now, here's one that would catch my interest as a student. Banned and challenged books.
Yes.
Generally speaking, why are they banned?
There's a puritanical streak, I think, in many societies, but we have it in our own American society today. And so I think they are banned primarily for maybe expressing political views that are unusual or against the mainstream. But the main reason that books are banned is because of depiction of sexual acts, I think, and language that's considered inappropriate for young ears to hear or for any ears to hear. So those are really the main reasons they're banned. Even Chaucer was banned, certain tales. And in fact, I have a newspaper article, Chaucer's Tales Taboo for High School Class in Eureka, Illinois. That's fairly recently.
Oh, mm-hmm. All right. Now, let me tell the listeners that Dr. Carol Pullum, who teaches a course on Chaucer and other courses and concentrates in the Middle Ages period, has brought with her a book of This is Chaucer's works.
This is Chaucer's works, yes, in addition.
And this book is not in pristine shape, is it?
No, it isn't. It's falling apart.
It is well worn because you use it all the time.
I do. I refer to it all the time. I have it miserably scotch taped. Really, I should do a much better job in repairing this, to me, most valuable book.
Isn't it great to have an old book that is an old friend? And you're not looking at a screen. You can actually handle it.
Oh, yes.
You can turn pages without clicking on the screen.
That's right.
Little illustrations along the way. You make your notes in the margin.
Oh, it's full of
just great stuff.
Handwriting, yes. I am an inveterate writer in books.
Now, are you trying to correct Chaucer and what he's writing there? You write in the margin?
No, yeah. I do not try to correct Chaucer. The most I'll do in terms of an edition of Chaucer is maybe to correct a typo or two. I am not aware of any typos in this edition, which is quite remarkable. But I do have notes on the meanings of some of the words. Language has changed so much since the Middle Ages, and some of the meanings of our words have changed, and some have not. And it's important to know the difference between the words whose meanings have changed and not, if you really want to understand Chaucer. For example, the word lust has changed completely. In Chaucer's time, it was an innocent word.
Oh.
It was all her lust was to do this. It was just
her desire.
What she wanted to do. It was her desire. Yes, it had no sexual innuendo whatsoever. But today, so it's important to know that so that you don't mistakenly think that Chaucer is implying something when he's not. On the other hand, the word prick has exactly the same connotations today as it did in the Middle Ages. And so you can... If you see a joke, which Chaucer does do using that word, you know it really was a joke in Chaucer's time, and it still is today.
Now, speaking of language and Chaucer, did he write in what we call Middle English?
Yes, he did.
Yes.
He wrote in Middle English, and many people mistakenly say that Chaucer wrote in Old English. Oh, I can't understand that
because
Chaucer.
The 14th century seems so long ago.
It does. Yeah. It does. And because his language is so very different. But really, Old English was the English being written around the year 1000. And if you were to look at Old English, you would not be able to pick out really any words. In fact, when I was in graduate school at Lehigh, Old English was one of my second languages that I used for my degree. You had to take two additional languages beyond English for the PhD then, and Old English.
Old English qualified.
Qualified, yes.
Did Middle English qualify?
No, not at all.
No.
Not at all.
It's too similar to modern English.
It is. It's too similar to modern English. And if you read it, it's much easier to understand than if you hear it. What has really changed is not so much the spelling. Well, the spelling has changed somewhat. A few meanings of the words have changed, yes. But the sound has changed tremendously.
Do we have a good grasp on how the sounds of the words used to be pronounced in Chaucer's time?
Yes, we do. Of course, they didn't have recordings.
Let's get you to do some of that a little bit later.
Okay, sure. I'd be glad to.
In our time today. Mm-hmm. Good. And you also teach Writing the World, Women Winners of the Nobel Prize for Literature. Now, that's an online offering.
It is,
only.
Yes. Only online. Mm-hmm.
And so where are you when you are teaching the students, and are they there at the same time?
No, it's not a synchronous online course. It's asynchronous, which means that the students may take the course whenever they want to. Of course, there are weekly and daily assignments, but they may do them on their own time. There is no time when they all have to be together chatting or something like
that. Is this a series of lectures that you put online?
Yes, it's a series of lectures and PowerPoints that I have put up online, and then discussion websites, and all of the students get together to discuss the literature that they have read. After they have heard the lectures, and I get in there and discuss the literature along with them. They do a lot of writing, and I give them feedback on their writing, and it's an intense course. Students who finish it really end up loving the course, but there are students who sometimes take an online course, I think, because they think it might be easier.
And they could do it at their own pace, and they can do it at 2 a.m. if they want to and whatnot.
And they can do it at 2 a.m., but the one thing they can't do is wait until 2 weeks before the end of the semester and then do everything. It's simply not possible to put all that time in.
And these students would come from all over the U.S.?
Oddly enough, most of them are our own traditional and life and evening students, SAGE students, who take courses at Cedar Crest, who come to the campus for other courses, but perhaps they have a semester where they're working more hours than they normally do, or they want to be able to really stay home. Maybe they have a long commute to the college and they want to be able to stay home and take the course there.
But you can get them together then at some point during the semester. They can see each other face to face.
No, they never do.
Oh, they never do.
They never see each other, and I never see them.
All right. This is the 21st century.
It is.
Right?
Yes, it is.
That's what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, outside the classroom, you love traveling to your two favorite cities, New York City and London.
Yes, I do.
And running through the streets of Allentown every morning with Patty, your big black dog.
Absolutely,
yes.
What
kind of a dog is it?
He is a Bouvier de Flandres. He's 7 years old right now. He's large for that breed of dog, and we run 5 kilometers every morning.
All right. That's a workout.
He needs his exercise, and so do I.
Yes. My guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse is Dr. Carol Pullum, and our topic, allegedly, is Geoffrey Chaucer. And we're going to get to him starting right now. We're talking about teaching medieval literature at the undergraduate level. And before we get specifically into Chaucer, Carol, let's take a question. Why do we still read medieval literature? Medieval just makes it sound as if it's so far in the past that why should we be interested, really?
I think there are many reasons we should be interested in reading literature of the past. One of them is that the really intelligent authors of the past still have a lot to tell us, and we have a lot to learn from them. But a big reason is the perspective that it gives us on our own culture. I think many times we take for granted many aspects of our culture as either things that are completely natural, things that have to be, things that are even that we're progressive and that everything is better now than it used to be. And I mean, there are many views that that most people, I think, have about our own culture. When you look at a culture that's 700 years in the past, you begin to see how people are still the same. What is it that you could possibly call human nature? I'm not sure that that even exists, and there are arguments that it does not exist, that everything is socially constructed, and there is no human nature. But you can see the similarities, and they are enlightening. You can see huge differences, and it makes you question the assumptions that you make about your own society and your own culture. Why can't we do this differently? Well, this was done like this long ago. I never realized that. Is that good? Is it a bad thing? It really opens up our minds about our own lives and our own culture.
One of the things that I enjoy doing, too, just in my own mind, when I'm dealing with literature that is old, like medieval literature, is trying to picture myself in that society. What kind of work would I have been doing? How would the family have been living? No paved roads. Pigs running around the streets, gathering garbage, and all those things.
Absolutely. I do that all the time. Yes. What was it like in London, particularly in the 1300s?
Would you have been able to run your big black dog early in the morning, every morning?
Probably not. At least not wearing what I wear to run today.
That would have been banned for sure.
It would have.
This is Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY, serving the Lehigh Valley and beyond. I'm John Pierce, your host. And my guest this evening, Dr. Carol Pullum, is a professor at Cedar Crest College, and you've been there since 1986. So you have deep roots there, plus being an alumna of the college.
Yes.
From years previous. Mm-hmm. So we're chatting about medieval literature, and we're going to get more specifically into Geoffrey Chaucer, who is 14th century, after we take a break. Time for us to pause for a moment, listen to an important message, and we'll be back in 60 seconds.
In 2017, WDIY is celebrating 22 years on the air. If you listen to WDIY, support the station by becoming a member today. Members are our most reliable source of support. We couldn't be here without you. To become a member, visit wdiy.org or call 610-694-8100. WDIY, serving the Lehigh Valley and beyond.
Celtic Fair, a celebration of Celtic music and culture, from its roots in Ireland, Scotland, Wales, Brittany, and Galicia, to its branches in Australia, Cape Breton, Canada, Chicago, New York, Philadelphia, and the Lehigh Valley. Music, interviews, and a weekly culture calendar, every Thursday from 7 to 9, here on WDIY.
Our topic this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse is Geoffrey Chaucer, an English poet who wrote The unfinished work, The Canterbury Tales, considered one of the greatest poetic works in English. Chaucer was born circa 1340 in London. Carol, we don't know exactly the year that he was born.
No, we don't, unfortunately.
But in 1357, he became a public servant to Countess Elizabeth of Ulster and continued in that capacity with the British court throughout his lifetime. The Canterbury Tales became his best known and most acclaimed work. And he died in the year
1400.
And we are sure about that, just
yes.
Not about his birth year.
Right, right. It was October 25th, actually.
So
yes.
You know exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So he lived to be 60 years old, which in those days was a ripe old age, wasn't it?
It was, yes, it was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So let's have a little sample of what the Canterbury Tales sounds like. Tell us where you're reading in the text, and let's hear a little bit of Middle English.
Okay, I'm going to read, I think, maybe the first 12 lines of the Canterbury Tales, of the general prologue of the Canterbury Tales, which is the absolute start, the beginning of the tales in Middle English. One that April with his sure sota, the drought of March hath pierced to the rota, and bathed every vein in switch liquor, of which virtue engendered is the floor. Juan Zephyrus ache with his sweeter breath, in spirit hath in every holt and heath the tender cropis, and the younger son hath in the ram his haver course y run. And smaller fool is makin' melodia that sleppin' all the nicht with open ear, so pricketh hem natur in her courages, than longin' folk to gone on pilgrimages.
That is Middle English.
Yes.
Geoffrey Chaucer.
Yes.
And what is that in modern English?
In modern English. When April, with its sweet showers, has pierced the drought of March to the root and bathed every plant in such liquid from which life develops. When the wind, Zephyrus is a personification of the wind, mythological. When the wind with his sweet breath has breathed on every meadow and every piece of land, the tender crops, and the young sun has gone halfway through its course in the ram. Now, that needs a little explanation, because in Chaucer's time, people were very much attuned to astrology. And to them, astrology and astronomy were the same things.
Interesting.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, they were. And they were also very acceptable in their religion. Because in many medieval churches, you can look up at the ceilings and see painted the signs of the zodiac. So it was all one system, they believed, that worked together. God controlled the stars and the planets, and so there was no conflict between looking at your horoscope and then believing in God. Anyway, so when the sun had gone halfway through the ram, that means halfway through Aries in the spring, which would bring us maybe to about the middle of April. And of course, people study this and try to determine what day exactly did the pilgrims leave from Southwark Cathedral in London. And so we're about the middle of April, and small birds make their melodies that sleep all night with open eyes. So nature pricks them in their hearts or gives them the ardor that they're so full of life and love they can't sleep. Again, I'm going to just explain something here. Small birds were believed to have sex all the time what's happening here is that it's the beginning. It's the beginning of spring. Everything's waking up. The plants are waking up. The birds are starting to do their thing. And sleeping all night with open eye is a reference to the courtly love tradition and belief that when you fall in love, you are unable to sleep. And so that brings us even more towards the idea that something to do with love is going to happen here at the beginning. And then we get the word prick. Remember I mentioned earlier about that word. It has the same connotations in Chaucer's time. So pricketh hem nature in her courages. So nature pricks them in their hearts. They're falling in love. Then what's going to happen? We expect the next line to be something to do with love. And Chaucer completely throws us out of the ballpark by saying, then longen folk to go on pilgrimages. Then folk want to go on pilgrimages. Then they get religious. No, they don't. They don't want to do that at all. And so right from the beginning of the Canterbury Tales, we have this poet who is setting up his readers for something and then completely destroying it and turning us in another direction.
And he's telling the readers that he's going to be playful, too.
Absolutely.
With his, and does that happen with all the, of the... There are 24 tales,
yes.
Correct?
Yes.
Does it happen through all the 24 tales, this playfulness?
It's not... I will say a qualified yes. A qualified yes. Sometimes the playfulness is less obvious than this. Less humorous. Sometimes it's just quite serious and intellectual, but it's still playfulness. It still makes us question, who is saying this? Is this Chaucer the poet? Is this Chaucer the pilgrim? Because he writes himself into the poem.
Okay.
So he's not only the author, he's one of the characters as well. That's tricky.
How many characters were there on this pilgrimage?
Well, we're not quite sure. It could be 29 or it could be 32. There's a puzzling line in the general prologue about the number of priests that are along on the tale, and we don't know if the line should read and priestess three, which would be and three priests, or and priest makes three. In other words, there's one priest and that.
Okay, you cannot tell whether priest in that context is a singular or plural.
No. No.
Interesting.
No, because there are many different, well, it's not that we can't tell whether it's singular or plural in one manuscript, but there's more than one manuscript, and one says one thing and one says something else. And so we're not really sure which one Chaucer intended.
About how many manuscripts are there?
Oh, that's something I don't know. I really don't
but
know.
But many.
But there are many, and some are more reliable than others.
Okay. Yeah, I had a professor of medieval French literature who told us one time that the great work in French, the Chanson de Roland, has just one manuscript, and it's in Oxford. And he said, so you have the advantage that you don't have competing manuscripts, so you deal with just the one, but you have the disadvantage that you don't have the competing manuscripts to fill in and to substantiate what is questionable about that one text.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Oh. And we use not only different Chaucerian manuscripts to figure out what it was that he really wanted, but we also compare Chaucer's manuscripts to the sources that he used. And we figure out what he changed about the sources. That is really something interesting to do, to give you an insight into what an author's intentions were.
And his intentions at the beginning, when Chaucer began this work, I believe was to have each pilgrim tell four tales.
Yes.
Two going to Canterbury and two returning to London.
That's right.
And it didn't turn out that way because Chaucer died before he could do more than 24. Is that the
That's
way
That's right,
it was?
Unfortunately, yes.
So
yes.
He did this in later life.
He did. We think he began the Canterbury Tales in around 1387. Right. And one of the reasons for that, and there are others, is this reference in the beginning to the date and with the astronomy connection, and people have looked up actual pilgrimages around that time, and they're not completely sure, but they believe that he is actually writing about a pilgrimage that took place in 1387.
Uh-huh. And what was there about Canterbury that made that the destination of the pilgrimage?
Canterbury was the place where Thomas à Becket was murdered in 1180, 81, by the king's men. And he became a saint after he was murdered there. Thomas à Becket was the Archbishop of Canterbury in 1180. And he was doing things that were angering King Henry at the time. And the story goes that King Henry, back in his castle, in his palace, was mumbling to himself in anger and said, "Will someone rid me of that bothersome priest?" And his men heard him say that and thought, "Oh, you know, we can make the king really happy if we go kill this man that he's really angry at." Unfortunately, when the king's men got to Canterbury, they encountered Thomas à Becket. He was the Archbishop of Canterbury, in prayer at the altar. Mm-hmm. And they marched right into the church and they killed him. They took a sword and cut off the top of his head right there in front of the altar. It was a terrible crime, because in medieval times, even criminals could have sanctuary in the church. If you committed a crime, you could run into a church and be protected by God, it was considered. And so this was a terrible crime against not only the archbishop, but against God himself.
And that was 2 centuries before Chaucer comes
along. It was.
And so is it the understanding then that from the time that Thomas à Becket was murdered until Chaucer comes along, that there was a pilgrimage every year to Canterbury?
Would not have started until after he was canonized, and I'm not sure of the date of his canonization. But when Becket became a saint, then there were pilgrimages, probably more than one a year. It was a real business, and I say business because it was, quite frankly. Pilgrimages in the Middle Ages were very, very common. They were not only to places like Canterbury Cathedral, but they were all over the religious world at the time. They would run pilgrimages to Jerusalem. They'd run them to
Rome.
Rome, yes, certainly. St. James at Compostela.
Exactly.
All over Christian Europe.
Yes, those were the 3 big ones
there. Those were, yes.
And then Chaucer wrote about the one to Canterbury. Does Chaucer say in his tales how this group got together? Was there a leader who brought them all together? How did that happen?
Yes, it was very common for pilgrimages to take off from Southwark, which is, well, back in Chaucer's time, it was not technically part of London. Today it is. It's on the south bank of the Thames River, and Southwark Cathedral is still there. The pilgrims used to gather in Southwark to take off for Canterbury, which was in that direction. And so they would gather they're at an inn, the Tabard Inn, which unfortunately has been torn down.
Oh.
But there's still a little plaque in Southwark where the Tabard Inn used to be, and it is on the wall of a print shop right now, but unfortunately it's gone. But they gathered together there at the inn, and Harry Bailey, the owner of the inn, was the one who suggested that they all tell two tales on the way down and two tales on the way back, and then the winner, chosen by all the pilgrims, would have a dinner paid for by all the pilgrims at Harry Bailey's inn when they get back. Now, this was a clever ruse for Harry because it would assure him that on the way back to London, all the pilgrims would again eat at and stop at and maybe stay at his inn in Southwark before they went off to their own homes.
Yes.
So it was very clever. And it was also, we learned later, very clever on his part because he had a kind of overbearing wife, to put it mildly. And she was full of anger and liked to goad him into fulfilling her angry wishes. Let's just put it that way. And so he really looked forward to times when he could travel away from home.
All right. That's mm-hmm. understandable.
Mm-hmm.
This is Dr. Carol Pullum from Cedar Crest College. She teaches courses on Chaucer and other courses on medieval literature, and we're exploring some of those things. When we come back from our next break, Carol, we're going to talk about what medieval literature has to say to us today, because this is your contention, that it's not just historically that we are interested because we're interested in history, but that it really does have a bearing on who we are today or how we think and how we react to the world. So, listeners, stay tuned because we are going to continue with more chatting here about medieval literature and particularly Geoffrey Chaucer. And Carol, another question that I have before we go to our break is, were there other places in England besides Canterbury that were known to be destinations for pilgrimages? Or is Canterbury the only one or the big one?
Canterbury is the big one. There were certainly other centers of religion. Norwich was one, and there was Julian of Norwich lived there, who was considered a very holy woman. And so people would go to pray to her and to talk to her. And there were others as well. In the Middle Ages, there were people who shut themselves away from public life. Julian of Norwich was one who did that. And they would sometimes even build extensions onto the cathedrals and have these, I guess you might call them hermits, live in seclusion inside these little huts that were attached to the cathedrals. And so there were a number of large cathedrals that had these holy people living in seclusion outside of them. And people would go to pray to those people. But
Canterbury was the big one.
Yes.
It's mm-hmm. time for us to take a break, folks, and we will be back in 60 seconds.
For program support of WDIY, we thank Lehigh County, Northampton County, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
For program support on WDIY, we thank ASAP Mailing of the Lehigh Valley, a locally owned and operated mailing and fulfillment company offering marketing and production solutions for your custom mail piece, taking your marketing project from idea to delivery, creating a program that meets your mailing, marketing, and fulfillment requirements. For more information, 484-285-0204 or ASAPmailing.com.
Medieval literature, what does it have to say to us? Carol, let's, Dr. Carol Pullum, my guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY, serving the Lehigh Valley and beyond. I'm John Pierce, Neil Heaver, our operations director, is doing our engineering for us this evening. We're talking about medieval literature. Let's just define the Middle Ages. As I understand it, about the year 500 to 1500.
Yes.
The Middle Ages.
Right.
But most of what we know about the Middle Ages comes from, say, the year 1000 or 1100 forward.
That's right.
We don't know very much about the other. There's a professor of mine who just hated the term the Dark Ages.
I knew you would bring that up.
And I heard then later on that the Dark Ages were really before we have any records that we can go back and look at, any texts that we can find, which are about from the year 1000 or 1100 or so.
Yes, so, that's true. It really, I don't think today most historians or readers of literature consider those times from 500 to 1100 the Dark Ages. Right. Not anymore, no.
Good. That's a good thing. Mm-hmm. So why are we even talking about medieval literature today? What does Chaucer have to say to us across nearly seven centuries?
I think Chaucer has much to say to us. For one thing, we can look at Chaucer and see how much society has changed and how much we as people still remain the same. And I think it's important for us to get a sense of that when we look at our own world and analyze our own world and make judgments about it. When we take for granted, for example, certain beliefs or the way things are in today's world, that maybe we should not be taking for granted, because things have been very different before and can potentially become very different again.
Now, you mentioned before that there is controversy over whether human nature actually exists. That surprised me, because I've always taken it as a given. People will say, well, you know, people were just as corrupt 1,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago as they are today. People were just as jealous. All of these human problems that we have, well, it's human nature.
We do, and I think we really need to be careful about saying that something is human nature when actually humans did not have that quality during certain time periods or were not doing those things during certain time periods. I think it's easy to just throw up our hands and say, well, it's human nature, because that gives us an excuse not to work to change things.
But if
you look back to the Middle Ages, you find some things that are remarkably similar to the way we are today, and remarkably different as well. For example, one of the qualities of existence that medieval English people thought was most frightening was not necessarily the fires of hell, if you were to be a bad person. I mean, it wasn't the flames that were the worst part of hell. To them, it was chaos. Chaos was far worse than burning.
So you're
flesh.
Talking about chaos after death?
But during life
during
as well.
Life.
Chaos was really something to be avoided. And I sometimes have to smile, because today we see sometimes in the business world deliberate attempts to bring about chaos, because we sometimes believe growth can come from chaos.
Yes.
And this is so very different from the Middle Ages, who were very focused on strict order, order of society, order of rank in society. If you were at this rank, you just were always at that rank. You could never change.
You're talking about nobility.
Nobility.
As well as peasants.
Exactly. To the extent that they actually codified it in law, so that if you didn't make enough money yearly, you were not allowed to have a knife with a silver scabbard.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. So. And today, we don't have that at all. Today, it's right. If you can afford it, or even if you can't, if you can get it on credit, you can appear to be any really wealth that you want to, if you can figure out how to do it. But they actually had laws preventing that.
Now, you talk about cultural assumptions.
Yes.
What do you mean by that exactly?
I think I mean that it's a cultural assumption that humans are just like this and always have to be like this or always have to behave in this way. And some things that we take for granted that we believe humans, you know, this is human nature, is not necessarily human nature. I think one thing, here's an example of a cultural assumption. I think today in the U.S., we look back on history with a very generalized view of history and we say, women have come so far in history. And so it's an assumption that history is progressive.
Yes.
Okay. Uh-huh. I would argue that we should not rely on that assumption. I don't think at all that history is necessarily progressive. I think it's entirely possible that women can lose some of the rights that they have gained in the last 200 years. And I think it's important to be vigilant about that. Women had freedoms in Chaucer's time that they did not have later in the 18th century.
Interesting. Do you have an example of?
Yes, they could own their own businesses. Now, there were women, I'm sure you can find women in the 18th century who did own their own businesses, but it was much more difficult with the rules about marriage and inheritance and things for women to maintain autonomy in the 18th century than it was in the 14th century when Chaucer was writing.
Wow.
And one of the prime examples, of course, is the wife of Bath. And she was even married. She was married 5 times.
Now, the wife of Bath does give a tale. It's one of the
24. Yes, she does.
Of the 24 tales. Mm-hmm. I want to ask you, when I'm thinking back of my college years and introduction to Chaucer and the tales, for some reason, the name of the tale that comes to my mind right away is The Pardoner's Tale.
Oh, yes.
I don't know why particularly. Maybe mm-hmm. I was fascinated by the word pardoner or the rank of pardoner. Tell us, do you have a favorite tale of the 24?
Oh, I wish I had thought of that before I came in. I have favorite tales.
Okay. Maybe you don't have one that's a favorite.
I really enjoy the Nun's Priest's Tale. The Nun's Priest's Tale is about Chanticleer, the rooster. And I think that I enjoy that tale so much because of all the digressions in it and the layers of meaning. That tale has perhaps more layers of meaning in it than any other tale in the Canterbury Tales. And this is what Chaucer does, and this is what makes it so much fun to read Chaucer. Every time one reads a tale, one can find a new thing in it.
Mm.
He has so many levels of understanding of each tale and different sections of various tales that rereading Chaucer is always an adventure. It's never the same. You can always find something new and stumble across a new idea when you're reading Chaucer. And the layers, first of all, are obvious because you have Chaucer the author, you have Chaucer the pilgrim, supposedly narrating what's happening to him and interacting with some of the pilgrims. Then you have the pilgrims themselves telling their tales. So Chaucer supposedly is not actually telling these tales. It's the pilgrims that are telling the tales. And in fact, sometimes Chaucer even says, well, don't blame me for this tale. This is a really, really raunchy tale.
Right. Well, that's a good way to get through censors, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And censorship.
It is. It is.
And you mentioned
way.
That mm-hmm. that his tale, I don't, would the whole collection of tales have been banned at a certain point, or only certain tales?
Only certain tales, yes. Mm-hmm. In the 19th and early 20th century, many editions, most editions of Chaucer were published without certain tales. So again, here we go with a view of history where things change, where things that were acceptable in even polite society in Chaucer's time, although he does give us warnings about certain tales because he knows that there will be a few people in his audience who might be upset when they hear these tales. Things that were acceptable then by the 19th century, the end of the 19th century, were not even being published in collections of the Canterbury Tales. They were just being bowdlerized. They were being removed from the collections of the tales.
And you mentioned people hearing these tales.
Mm-hmm.
Now, most people in the 14th century didn't know how to read and write.
Right.
Now, was the audience for Chaucer's tales mostly upper class who could get a copy of the tales and read them, or was it did it appeal to the masses, and most people would have heard the tales rather than reading them?
Well, that's an interesting question. The upper class definitely would have heard the tales, but not necessarily with a written copy. In Chaucer's time, the late 14th century, England did not have the printing press yet.
Mm-hmm.
It was so close to having it, but they did not have the printing press. So every manuscript of the Canterbury Tales from Chaucer's time and just later had to be painstakingly written out by hand. So not many people would have had their own copies of the Canterbury Tales. And there are even illustrations of people reading the Canterbury Tales to an audience
Job.
In Chaucer's time. There are medieval illustrations in manuscripts of the tales being read out loud. So I would say that the most common way that even the nobility who could read gained access to the Canterbury Tales was by having a reading in a room with one's guests.
Would be what we'd call a soiree.
A soiree, yes.
If
a soiree
being,
of medieval literature. Oh, how wonderful. Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. With some good ale being poured around the room.
Absolutely.
And
yes.
Whatnot.
Yes.
And I'm curious about the existence of Geoffrey Chaucer, because for years there has been some dispute over whether Shakespeare really wrote what we attribute to Shakespeare.
Yes.
And I don't know where that stands today with scholars, but with Chaucer, it doesn't seem to be a question.
No, there has never been a question about the authorship of the Canterbury Tales. Perhaps because Chaucer's life trajectory matches the literary quality of the tales, whereas Shakespeare has some mysterious blanks in his life, and some people question whether he really had the education to write. And I'm not weighing in on that controversy. Shakespeare is not my specialty.
But Shakespeare comes two centuries after Chaucer.
Yes, he does. Isn't that amazing? Yes.
Now, I think it's great that you have made the statement, what makes it fun to read Chaucer. Many of our students who come along and are thinking in terms of 20th century and 21st century, and then they come across a requirement that they must go into literature that is older than that, including
yes.
Chaucer. would think right away, oh, going in with a bad attitude. Oh, I'm not going to understand this.
Yes.
When you teach Chaucer on an undergraduate level, are the students reading the Middle English, or is it a Modern English translation?
They are reading Middle English.
That's tough.
It's tough, but it's not rocket science.
Okay.
It takes some perseverance at the beginning. But if you push your way through the Middle English with maybe a glossary of hard words, words that are very different that occur frequently in Chaucer's Canterbury Tales.
Like lust.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. It can be done fairly simply if you're willing to persevere through those first couple of weeks of the course and of reading. And then you really do pick it up. Reading the Canterbury Tales in print is much easier than hearing it read. Hearing it read is, because of the great vowel shift that occurred after Chaucer's lifetime, when most of the main vowels in the English language changed their sound, it made Middle English very, very difficult to understand hearing it from our point of view. But the spelling is very much the same for most of the words as it is today. In fact, you can figure out, oh, this is where the silent E's come from. We have silent E's. But in Old English, those E's were all sounded. And in Middle English, we believe in Chaucer's lifetime that they were starting to disappear. And so sometimes they would be pronounced, sometimes they would not, depending on the rhythm of the poetic line.
This is all so fascinating. And Dr. Carol Pullum, believe it or not, our time is up.
I can't believe it.
Yes.
We just scratched the surface.
She is so enthusiastic about Geoffrey Chaucer and medieval literature. It's refreshing. And we thank you so much for coming in to regale us and also to entertain us, but also to inform us about the importance of medieval literature and Geoffrey Chaucer particularly. And we wish you well with your courses at Cedar Crest College.
Thank you.
And with your big black dog.
Thank you.
Let's give him
thank
a shout out. What's his name?
Paddy.
Paddy is the name of the big black dog.
Yes, he is.
This has been Lehigh Valley Discourse. We thank you listeners for tuning in. I thank Neil Heaver for doing our engineering work today. And until we meet again, remember to be gentle with your neighbor.